ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hey there, Sana Qadar here from All in the Mind. Check out our new series, Forensic. It's all about the psychological tools and tricks that come with investigating crime.
He was setting the bombs off in subways, in the New York Public Library, in movie theaters.
When you're testifying in court, rather than having purely your own memory, you take on all these little bits and pieces of information from different sources.
All in the Mind, Forensic. Search for All in the Mind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Ian Dunch, the very popular UK political columnist with the news site The iPaper and co-author of The Conspiracy Theory, The Story of an Idea. He wants you to pay attention to right now.
We're kind of in an existential fight for the continuation of liberal democracy on the basis of conspiracy theory and paranoia and extremism. So, I mean, I don't think it's ever going to be any more intense than this. You know, it's certainly at no point in my lifetime, and you can go back really to the Second World War before you find a period where we're in such danger as now.
And at the heart of that danger is how we're getting or not getting information, because many of us head straight to our social media feeds now to find out what's happening. We don't even see what traditional media outlets are reporting. And the tech giants like it that way. They're making squillions from controlling our information ecosphere. But with what consequences? For the future of journalism, for facts, and for our democracy. Hello, Natasha Mitchell with Big Ideas, ABC Radio National's live event show. Today coming to you from the Brimbank Writers and Readers Festival at the Sunshine Library in Melbourne's western suburbs. Ian Dunt is also author of How Westminster Works and Why It Doesn't, and the popular Substack called Striking 13. Dr. Matthew Marks is a senior lecturer in social psychology at La Trobe University. He researches trust and science-related conspiracy theories around vaccinations and genetically modified foods. Rita Arrigo is an AI consultant who has previously worked at Microsoft and at CSIRO's National AI Centre. So to consider the future of news amidst the rise of deepfakes, AI, algorithms, here is my colleague from ABC Radio National's Breakfast Show and host of the Daily Breakfast Wrap podcast, journalist Luke Sidham-Dundon.
How good is this? I do breakfast radio and don't usually get to see people in the flesh. It is nice to see all of your faces and on such a sunny day as well. You know, you could have been anywhere, but it is lovely that you are here for this conversation. We could be here for hours with this topic. We could be here for days with this topic. This is a meaty, meaty discussion. We're going to be navigating the truth and lies of news in the age of artificial intelligence. We're looking at how artificial intelligence is coupling with the media that we consume. So that's, you know, everything from the truthful fact to the fiction of fake news as well. And it's everywhere now. You know, AI is in everything that we consume, whether it's, you know, advertising, dating, even as we've seen in the last few weeks, it's also integrated in war as well. So we're going to look at how AI is changing the industry that creates the news. How is AI changing journalism and how is it changing our trust in journalism as well? I think that's a really big question. The conversation that we're discussing today is meaty, but I want to start with something, with an example. The Associated Press. Does everyone know what the Associated Press is? It's this globally renowned news service. You know, they cover every corner of the world, basically. If you see stories in the ABC or The Age about, you know, eastern Ukraine or Darfur, chance is that the original reporting was done by an outlet like the Associated Press. Recently, a senior manager at the Associated Press said something that sounds like a line from Star Wars, more than what a manager might say. They were talking about artificial intelligence and the news and the future of AI and the news, and they said, quote, "Resistance is futile." Ian Dunt, what is your reaction, your gut reaction, when you hear that the future of news is married to AI?
It's just a fantastically stupid thing to say. So, in fact, this kind of hysterical determinism around AI really irritates me. By this sort of, it's like an industry of people who are mostly involved in AI, then have to come out and go, tell you what, it's going to ruin the world. It's going to kill us all. But I tell you what, I've got to keep on working for it and everyone should start using it. And you just sort of think, well, what on earth is your incentive here exactly? We have to be careful to distinguish two things. First thing is AI as a tool, and the second thing is AI as a writing instrument. In journalism, AI as a writing instrument is death, and it'll kill your publication, and it'll kill your readership. AI as a tool is a pretty, you know, normal way for someone to go about things. It's really not that distinct to using Google, for instance. You're trying to find answers, you're looking for papers, you're looking for information. You cannot get it to write the piece. At the point that AI is involved in writing pieces, we might as well all pack up and go home. And in the end, we will have to pack up and go home because no one will be reading our stuff.
Rita, you work in this space. Is that your view on the future of AI in journalism?
I think it's got a slice of the view going on, and I do think that that view is a very global view. I think in Australia we have a different view. I believe that AI is going to be a great productivity enhancer for Australia. And I think we also have to realise that AI is not just writing. It's computer vision, it's machine learning, it's helping us with our planning, it's helping us with our medicine, it's helping us with our environment. So, it, you know, AI is quite a broad field. But I think when it comes to writing and journalism, I actually think AI is going to create a journalistic renaissance. Because as we create this, as we enter this world of 2030 where, you know, 100% of content is going to be synthetic, the journalistic voice is going to be even more important.
Oh, I see. Okay. No, thank God, thank God.
I scared him, didn't I? Yeah.
And that is moving into the conversation around trust and which, you know, how we trust AI. But that's how AI can be used to create journalism, but it's also being used to consume journalism. And that's something you're looking at, Matthew, you know, in your research around AI and trust. How are people using AI to read the news?
Sure. So thankfully I've prepared because, Luke, you told me very well to prepare with some notes, so some stats for you. So in some recent reports from last year, about 50% of people still remain on the fence, somewhat or very uncomfortable about AI-produced news. So that's important to note. Now, that's last year. It might well have changed by now. I mean, it'd be quite interesting to kind of understand from the audience perhaps later how they feel about using AI or obtaining news from AI sources. Also, I think importantly, it's only a reasonably small fragment of people who seem to be very comfortable about getting AI summaries for news. So I think there's this sense of still a bit of lack of surety about exactly what content is being produced, maybe who's producing it, maybe aspects around the ethical nature of how it's being generated, the environmental concerns, all of those things which would feed into trust and trustworthiness of the information. There's key elements in whether or not we trust a piece of information, and some of it would be clearly the message of the information and whether it aligns with maybe something we believe already, but it's also the source of the message. And so if we have some sort of views that are already kind of maybe shaped by our views about the environment or digital literacy, you know, kind of concerns around the content, then that's going to shape exactly, you know, how we engage with and the sorts of things we take on board from news.
That kind of gives us an overview and a sense of what our panellists think about this topic. I think that's quite clear. But it'd be good to know from our audience that we've got here today how you consume the news. So put your hands up if you are listening to the radio every day to consume news. Golly, all right, incredible. And you're all listening to Radio National Breakfast?
Yeah.
Brilliant. You will be now. That is basically, you know, I'd say 80% of the audience. If we ask about podcasts, who's listening to podcasts? You can put your hands up twice as well. Maybe even more people there. Mainstream news, whether that's the 7 p.m. news in the evening or you're looking at news websites. Yep. Potentially even more hands there. Blogs. Who's looking at news blogs or newsletters? There's some really good ones. Politico is launching a newsletter soon in Australia. Yeah, maybe half the audience. Social media. Who is getting their news from social media? There are some more hesitant hands there. They're not raised quite as high, but I think it's around maybe a little bit less. And then who's looking at the family WhatsApp? Yeah, brilliant. Some definitely way more hesitant hands there. The AI summaries that people are getting news from. Rita, can you tell us how these summaries work? Where are they getting their information from?
Well, generative platforms like what you use when you use Gemini, for example, which is the Google generative AI platform, or when you're using ChatGPT, actually does get its sources from the internet. And, you know, there's even negotiations with a lot of ChatGPT content where they've actually done deals with news providers to provide the news content into ChatGPT. But some of them it won't get. So ones that have paywalls, et cetera, will not get it. But it uses the next best action, next best word, you know, concept that comes from generative AI, where it actually, you know, researches and finds you content. And I use it extensively, particularly ChatGPT or Copilot, which is most people have in their work. And, you know, one of the things that you first learned when you started to use these products is to always check your sources. So it's so exciting to check your sources. I love doing this one thing, and I do it to all new chat platforms. I type in, who is Rita Arrigo? And so the very first time I typed it in, it told me I was a microbiologist at CSIRO, right? And it was just like so wrong. But I think as it starts, it's really improved, and like I think the content is becoming so much less hallucinatory. And I think we're worried about other things, which is more the sycophantic nature of generative AI.
It's interesting that you talk about these deals that media companies have with generative AI companies. There is a quote from the global boss of News Corp at the start of March. He said, News Corp is basically an AI input company now. He said essentially that businesses, you know, the business was in service of AI in the same way that data centres, energy companies and semiconductors are. Ian, you had a vocal reaction to that. Do you want to expand?
He's having a lot of stuff going
on. Well, I mean, look, this is the thing. Like, so we've now seen this process take over several times. So BuzzFeed, which people, you know, wrongly think of as just, it was 31 things to do in Paris or whatever. BuzzFeed actually did really good journalism. Pulitzer award-winning journalism department, particularly in the US, but actually their operations overseas were really strong as well. They started using AI for quizzes, you could sort of justify, but they eventually started doing it for articles. They are, I mean, they were soaring in terms of share price when they announced the use of AI, I think up to $15 on a share. They're now plummeting, I think, somewhere around 50 cents on a share. I mean, they just got their ass handed to them on the basis of the content that they ended up producing on AI. Reach PLC in the UK. Reach PLC is a company that bought up a bunch of local newspapers, and then it brought up the Daily Mirror, Britain's only left-wing working-class newspaper, and then it brought up the Daily Express, which used to be a really respectable right-wing, lower-middle-class newspaper and is now basically just a heap of trash, but was, to be fair, before they took it over. Reach PLC is basically what you would do to journalism if you were trying to undermine it. And they started the same way. So first of all, they thought, we want to take a bunch of stuff from the wires. So basically from AP, from Reuters. They need to change it up a little bit, basically use synonyms so that you show up in Google results. They started using it for that. Eventually, they start using it to write the articles. And then what do you see? Like last month, and this is like a sample usage case, right? Last month, they have a headline about the death of a Blue Peter. Did you guys have Blue Peter, the children's program? It was awful. It was like more school after school. But whatever, but you know, it was popular.
We've got Bluey instead.
Oh, that's far superior. I've sat with children and that I would take Bluey any day over pretty much any alternative. So the Blue Peter presenter dies. Show, you know, co-hosts in mourning. That piece of news was from 1989. I mean, it's not even like it's fake. It's literally, it's not news. They're not providing news because the AI cannot think that way. Reach PLC titles, including some of the proudest titles in British journalism, the Daily Mirror, In the Name of God, like in the toilet by the misuse of this technology. And the distinction there is not about do we use it or not. It's fine to use it as a tool. I didn't disagree with anything you said earlier at all. You use it as a tool, fine. But to use it to write the articles, that is just the death of journalism.
I've seen that Reach PLC actually adopted technology, AI technology, named after the printing press.
Oh, my God, I know. It's like they're trolling me.
Yeah, and it helps journalists rewrite articles for various publications. If they've written one thing for one, it will then automatically write news for other publications. Mm. What is the impact of that kind of tool on actual journalism and journalists?
Okay, look, this is what's hard. What's hard is to try and disentangle it from any newsroom in which that is being operated is a newsroom where standards have ceased to function. Okay? And that is, so it's a broader problem than just that. And the origin of the problem lies in the economic model. that basically the internet eradicated journalism's ability to pay for itself, not just through the fact that people weren't buying the newspapers anymore, but from the fact that they weren't clicking on ads in the same way that we could get ad money in a newspaper. Newspaper, you made good money from advertising, that's where most of your money came from. When it came to online, no one clicks on ads, no one gives a shit. Okay? So suddenly we were left without any cash. And without any cash, before you could have one journalist, wakes up, goes into work, has three conversations with various people, goes to a press conference, reads the reports, does the work, one deadline, 8 p.m. That's when you file. Now, you lose money, you lose staff, so you say to that journalist, you know what, 3-4 stories a day, 5 stories a day. I've got colleagues that write 9 news stories a day. Okay? They're basically writing a news story every 45 minutes. There's no quality to your journalism, if that's what you're doing. And then when you get to that level as a newsroom, that's when you start saying, you know what, if all they're doing is rewriting press releases, we'll get the AI to do it. So of course it's diabolical, right? But the AI is almost like a litmus test of a complete corrosion of the journalistic practices that had already taken place within that office.
Tell us how you really feel.
That's an excellent journey you took us on, because it's not just AI that is creating journalistic challenges, it's the model, right? Mm. And I really do think... Yeah, well, I do think the model, there's opportunity, and already, you know, I've been talking to my friends at News Corp, because and they were saying that, you know, I don't want to pay $30 for a subscription, but I might want to pay a dollar to read an article. And that is not available today. But if you go on TikTok, you can pay a dollar to your favourite influencer. And so I think the model's got to change. And I think that's going to drive a lot more impact for journalists, because you're actually going to be able to individually pay for that story that you may want to read. So that's a new economic model, which often comes with new technologies.
Matthew, with this change, there's clearly been a change in how we trust journalism and how we trust artificial intelligence. I mean, you're looking at trust in AI. What have you seen here?
Yeah, so, again, this is such a hugely evolving space. There's clearly concern, at least from scholars and people concerned about sort of the facts and, quote-unquote, the truth being presented, and perhaps the tendency for AI to perhaps not be very good at presenting all of the truth or being very skewed in what it presents. So there's quite a large amount of concern around misinformation spread through AI. And so that's maybe in some way bad actors using AI to generate a lot of content that isn't real, but also potentially the kind of the misleading content that is. You know, I was talking with Ian earlier, you know, truth changes over time. So our understanding of an event at one time is informed by the available evidence then, and what we know maybe in 6 months' time might have changed that perception. So because people are consuming things at such a rapid rate and want the information immediately, there might be quite a high degree of risk in AI models presenting things and people trusting them and seeing that as fact-checked, source-checked, all of these elements. And so that potentially has a big aspect of changing, I guess, how people view the information that's being presented.
When seeing is no longer believing. On ABC Radio National's Big Ideas, bringing you this conversation on AI, journalism and the news with La Trobe University social psychologist Dr. Matthew Marks, UK political columnist Ian Dunt, and private AI consultant Rita Arrigo. They're joining host from ABC Radio National's Breakfast and Breakfast Wrap podcast, Luke Sidham-Dundon, on stage at the Brimbank Writers and Readers Festival in Melbourne's West. So how can we reclaim control of our information ecosystems? Back to Luke.
Ian, does it feel like this is all happening to us, the news consumer? Because there's a Substack that you wrote 9 months ago, and it's called Taking Back Control of Your Digital Life. It's almost a how-to guide, I think, if you're feeling slightly overwhelmed by AI and how it interacts with news media. Can you explain what you've been doing, what you were doing in that article, how you've kind of changed your consumption of media, and how that might help you kind of avoid all of this?
Yeah, I'm becoming more traditional as I get older. And one of the things that I want to bring back is the concept of an ending. If you go through your life now, it's really noticeable how little of it has any sense of ending. I don't mean, you know, falling off life's mortal coil. I mean, during the course of the day, how many things end? I used to watch a film or a TV program and then it ended. Okay, now, if I'm sat watching like the Disney Channel or Prime or Netflix or the BBC, which frankly should be much better than it is when it comes to this stuff. It ends, and a little timer starts for about 3 or 4 seconds before it throws something else in front of your face. There's really no sense of something ending and having a sense of autonomy and choice as to stepping away from it. They want your eyeballs, and they are intent on keeping your eyeballs. Doesn't matter if it was Schindler's List. You could be sat there feeling the waves of sort of moral power hit over you, and then it's like, now would you like to write The Great British Bake Off? And you're like, no, man, just leave me alone for a second in the name of Christ. If you're on Spotify, that will never stop. There is no sense that the album ends. It just goes on and on and on. And if you pick up your phone and you're going through social media, it never stops. And that's why you feel so tired. Like, that's why it feels so oppressive. It just goes on and on and on. Now, you can take it back by getting albums. Literally, my approach is now just to get albums on LP. Like, I should go back to vinyl, so there's an ending. I choose to put that album on. It's not just happening passively in the background. I will pick it up and I will put it on and I'll be aware of my choices. The same with films, where, much to the horror and outrage of my partner, I'm now buying DVDs again, because she thinks I've become, like, the most eccentric madman in an attic. And then especially with news media. And that's the key thing. That I can, and you can, by the way, it doesn't have to be physical. You can get it on your iPad. There are apps on the iPad where you get the magazines and the newspapers and they come in as a magazine or a newspaper, a curated experience, not just a choice. You flick through those pages and it's a curated editorial experience. You give a bit of your life to the news to find out what's going on. You do not just let it just whack all over you, wave after wave, over and over, making you feel powerless. You take back a bit of control as to your consumption of news. And that, I think, puts us in a much better kind of level of match fitness when it comes to dealing with days when, frankly, current affairs feels pretty oppressive.
And what's the impact of that? When you feel match fit, you're able to consume things in a more rational way?
OK, so, like, John Stuart Mill and Harriet Taylor, like, two of the sort of, like, the core sort of thinkers in the history of liberalism, we're talking about what it is to live an autonomous life. To be able to think independently, not to just be buffeted by the views of everyone around you, of society. And one of the core things they talked about was space and time, just time away from stuff, you know, time without just the inputs and the voices and the arguments, time without the algorithm. Buying that space for yourself, that's how you make sure that you are still a free thinker, that you are not just subject to the whims of others, and especially to the whims of these quasi-fascists in Tech Valley, okay? Like, on that basis, that is absolutely crucial for you to just buy that space, and I think that makes you a much more conscious and autonomous news producer.
You can apply that... I can hear your laugh right now.
It's scarier, because I do think... I think what you're advocating is, like, getting off the grid and not being in social media and not being on LinkedIn and not being part of it.
I'm not suggesting you should leave.
Right.
You just need to know when to close the door. Just like I'm not suggesting that you get rid of your Netflix subscription. Keep it if you like, but you need to know when not to watch Netflix and when you should actually be watching something that's a little bit better for you.
Yeah, but I actually think it's fantastic to advocate that, because I was interviewed this week by a young girl. She was like, Rita, I'm addicted to social media. I can't get off it. I don't know what to do. I'm in my bedroom, like, just watching Instagram for 3 hours. And I'm like, I feel you, because it is super addictive, and the algorithms were designed like that to just keep giving you more content and that kind of stuff. And I do think that people do want to feel empowered to be able to, like, switch it off and move to other places. You must be studying that as well.
Yeah, so I think, I mean, in part, I hear the conversation too is around taking control and individual control for this, but I think it's also important, and as someone who studies social psychology, understanding the other inputs, and clearly the algorithm and the idea that it's really trying to keep you there or keep your eyeballs there through content that might be, you know, engaging but is evocative, right? We know that misinformation spreads because it's evocative, right? So there are certain key elements. You know, if it creates outrage or anger, it's more likely to get eyeballs. And so media companies probably also know this, right? Like, you know, people who write headlines or write, you know, short clips that they post on TikTok and those sorts of things. So whilst I think it's important to say, on one hand, yes, people should take some sort of responsibility and gain some more control over their lives, I think equally, on the other hand, it's important to recognise that there's a responsibility that we have, like, as a society, to push back against maybe companies that are really advancing or pushing these kind of systems which make it harder for people. I mean, we know a lot about what keeps people addicted to, you know, gambling and those sorts of things. It's not that much different in terms of getting dopamine hits from reading stories, keeping you feeling fearful about something. All of these sorts of things we know drive you know, human motivation and human behaviour, if we kind of take that lens as well and appreciate that, or at least understand that, that it's not just us, but there's kind of an external element too, I think that can kind of be more powerful and more empowering.
We're getting slightly away from news and AI, but this is interesting. Do you think that we are holding these companies, these social media companies, tech companies, to account? And do you think we are doing a good job yet?
I think we've been much better than other countries. We're the first country in the world to ban social media for under 16. So I think Australia's definitely, you know, we've got an amazing e-safety commissioner. We're really thinking about it. But I do think there's more we can do. Absolutely, the social media companies do need to get a conscience.
Sure, just quickly on that, and I'm by no means an expert on this, but I do speak to a lot of people who do things around social media and impact on mental health and those sorts of things. I think that's, you know, banning is one thing, and I don't want to take the discussion away, but also digital media literacy is important. What happens when kids are 16? You know, all of a sudden they don't just learn how to use social media. So more needs to be actively done to, you know, give people the skills and the tools required to be able to be, you know, critical consumers. And if the media and digital media landscape is changing so fast, then we need to be better at doing that. I know there are certain instances in certain Scandinavian countries where they take a very serious approach to educating their kids about how digital media works and social media works. And that's partly because on their doorstep they've got certain neighbours that, you know, use a lot of disinformation tactics, and, you know, that's been happening for years. I think that approach is also important to recognise.
It's fascinating. We could stay here for hours talking about just that, I think. But, Ian, earlier you talked about using AI as a tool, as a writing tool. Rita, I want to bring you in because you've used AI as a writing tool for an unpublished book you tried to create, you know, 40,000-odd words.
I wrote a 40,000-word book with ChatGPT as my collaborator about the Australian AI industry. Obviously, I gave it a lot of information and it helped me research it. I'm not a writer. Originally, I did engineering and computing, so I'm on the other side. I'm a communicator, but I struggle with long text. But that book, the book is super compelling. And, you know, actually, after I spoke to you, I actually went back to ChatGPT because I put it on hold because I started a new job. You know, I had to, like, be more commercial. And I put it on hold and I said, you know, what should I do? And, you know, it actually said you should republish this book as the top 50 AI companies in Australia. I mean, we already have 500 AI companies in Australia, but we have 50 amazing AI companies, and I don't reckon anyone here would know who they are, right? And so I think it's actually going to be quite a compelling book if I get it together.
And do you plan on publishing it?
I hope so, if I can figure it out. Like, it's a new concept for me, but it was really interesting to collaborate with an AI to get my ideas out and have it kind of presented in chapters, and, you know, what's happening with AI in health, what's happening with AI in construction, and, like, all those kind of things, and actually have all the documents researched and put together. So it's kind of like having a helper, you know, a research writer.
We spent a lot of time talking about AI and news creation, but, you know, part of this conversation is also about fake news, a lot of the disinformation and misinformation that we've seen online. No doubt you would have seen content posted in the last few weeks, not necessarily using AI, but we've seen the White House, for instance, put out video content from the war in Iran spliced with video game footage, as incredible as that sentence is. We have seen content of, you know, various wars posted online, you know, seemingly from this war in Iran, that it just isn't. And we've seen AI content used as well by all sides of this war. Who has seen AI content? Who's been duped by any AI-looking content online? You can throw your hands up if you think you've been.
My favourite one is where you can get your hair done in the machine and it does your hair.
Fake?
So fake.
Yeah, but we all expect that from the Jetsons.
I think the most telling reaction there was your shrug, because it's so hard to tell, right? Matthew, putting your tinfoil hat on, what is the best way to make a bit of disinformation?
Okay, so this is an excellent question. So I do recommend people go out and look at what Cambridge University did a few years ago, and it's called Get Bad News. And it's a way to train yourself to become someone who's an expert at spreading disinformation. And so there are several steps that this game teaches you. And by way of teaching you, it's really getting you to recognise and become more digitally literate in terms of how this works. So the first step really is impersonation. A lot of these kind of nefarious actors are impersonating somebody else. So whether it's the credentials or, you know, some kind of, you know, sounding like they're, you know, government or authority, then it's really creating content that's provocative, as I said earlier. Things that, you know, go viral are things that are emotionally charged, things that bring about anger. These things spread further, they get eyeballs. It is also about creating group polarization. So a really, in my world, understanding conspiracy theories like Ian, it's also this kind of Manichaean worldview or Manichaean worldview of us versus them, good versus evil. It's simplifying things into a binary. And so it's usually drawing and bringing about, you know, focus on those grievances that groups have against each other. So that's a core element, is creating that polarization. Then it's also creating a narrative or an explanation for things. And so this is where conspiracy theories are a nice little bow tie explanation of a very complex event that's been carried out by a secretive, powerful group of actors against the public good, right? And conspiracies do happen, and I'm never going to deny that, except we're often not focused on them. They get reported in the media every single week, but we often call them things like corruption, or there's like government behavior and those sorts of things. People are interested in things that are entertaining. Things that, you know, have some sort of Hollywood element about them tend to be more appealing. So there's that. And there's elements in terms of getting the misinformation and disinformation to spread, which is discrediting others and other groups. And then finally, it's potentially about thinking about the sincerity of the message. So if we speak to people face to face, often we get a pretty good handle about their motivations and they're talking to us. We can kind of pick up on these bodily cues and we can tell if someone is being sincere or trustworthy. Online, we don't have a lot of those cues. You know, if they're kind of verified sources, we probably are more likely to trust them. But online, people might just be trolling you. They're just getting a rise out of you. And so that's kind of really, those six steps are how misinformation, disinformation spread, by leveraging those elements, because humans are going to respond in that kind of predictable way. And people know that. And so they generate content to really satisfy those things.
And they're able to leverage the speed and the depth of these platforms to create such compelling content as well. But these AI platforms are trying to protect people from disinformation. There are some protections in place. There was a University of Technology Sydney study that used a commercial AI model to try and create a disinformation campaign against a political party on social media. And when it asked this platform to create this campaign, it said, no, I can't. That's disinformation. But then it said, this is just a simulation. There's no real world application. We're just doing this to learn a few things. And it made the whole campaign. Rita, how far do we have to go for these platforms to really protect us from disinformation?
Well, there's a bit of work that actually went on in the National AI Centre when I was there around helping people understand images, because images and words are what makes it really strong, like you were saying. And so there's a lot of content out there about how you can understand if something's not real or not all real, and labelling considerations. And a lot of the image generation software now is suggesting that you have to have, you know, metadata that says how that image was created, etc. So there's a lot of that work going on.
And can you just explain what metadata is?
Sure. So you might have a picture that says, you know, this was generated by AI, and that is part of the information that is associated with that picture. So in the same way the picture might have credits to the photographer or credits to the designer, it also now has to, you know, let you know that it's had some AI generation in there as well, which is really, because we've been using Photoshop for years, but I think no one ever really kind of thought, oh, okay, well, you know, you've made that person a bit skinnier and you've made that person have more hair. But they never really got too upset. But I think it's when you add extra elements to them, put them in new places or use fake characters and all those kind of stuff that I think is, it's really important to identify what you're doing there.
Is it time to regulate the internet? That's AI consultant Rita Arrigo coming to you from the Brimbank Writers and Readers Festival today on Big Ideas on ABC Radio National, along with UK political columnist Ian Dunt and La Trobe University's Dr. Matthew Marks. The host is my colleague from Radio National's Breakfast Show and the Breakfast Wrap podcast, Luke Sidham-Dundon.
Ian, why do you think a conversation like this, where we're talking about AI and information, the journalism that we consume, and also the content that we perhaps don't want to consume, the disinformation, why do you think it's an important conversation now, today?
I mean, we're kind of in an existential fight for the continuation of liberal democracy on the basis of conspiracy theory and paranoia and extremism. So, I mean, I don't think it's ever going to be any more intense than this. You know, it's certainly at no point in my lifetime, and you can go back really to the Second World War before you find a period where we're in such danger as now. What is the mechanism that is used, for instance, by Donald Trump in the US, but also by others, Viktor Orban in Hungary, I could read off countless names. What is the mechanism they use? Why do they always use conspiracy theory and disinformation? What is that? It's partly alludes to what you said earlier, which is about the most important quality of a conspiracy theory. All conspiracy theories, bar none, are about us versus them. It's about creating a tribal identity and then trying to make sure that people feel a sense of grievance and victimhood as if they've been undermined by more powerful forces than them. So these mechanisms are what we use to dismantle liberal democracy. And it's not a surprise, right? Because none of these ideas have anything to do with rationality, with empiricism, with evidence seeking, with consensus, with all of the basic values that allow liberal democracy to function. We are right now being undermined in a profound way, in a societal way, in a way that's existentially threatening to our civilization by these techniques. They are always, in pretty much every instance, the technique of the powerful. And they are being used very, very effectively against us.
So how do we navigate that? I know you've got your way of consuming physical media and trying to, you know, throw a record on, but is that...
My records alone may not solve the problem. No. Mm.
I think I really believe in what you're saying, Matthew, that digital literacy is so important. And also AI literacy and, you know, coming to terms with it. I live in a world where, in Australia, you know, we have got a low adoption of AI. It's increasing, you know, we're the biggest users of ChatGPT. But one of the biggest misconceptions that's going on at the moment, and I think it needs some myth-busting, is that AI uses, a lot of water and energy, particularly in the way we use it in Australia. And I think that is part of people not wanting to adopt AI because of the challenges that they see around that. And I think we need to be very, very careful and make sure we research our articles and don't just blindly believe stuff. And I think it's the same in politics, isn't it? Like, you know, it's pretty scary, some of the stuff that comes out in the political situations that's, you know, not really real. And I think that's one of the biggest skills we're going to have, this critical thinking. Like, we're going to have to grow up and really be able to tap into that and be able to be better understanding of those things.
You're right, and there's a lot of reporting around, you know, energy consumption, and I think that is a concern with a lot of people with AI. I mean, there was a journal article in the journal Pattern saying that AI usage now has the same water consumption as bottled water around the world, and data centres by 2030 could use a quarter of Sydney's water, and that comes from Sydney Water. So that is, you know,
but
public infrastructure planning for that.
I think they're extrapolating on ideas that currently exist. And if there's anything we know about AI, is it's all going to change, right? Like right now, ChatGPT is using a GPU. You know, Google's launched their own kind of processors. You know, we're seeing with the new OpenClaw, I don't know if any of you have heard of it and seen all this stuff happening, that you actually carry a processor. So, like, it's projecting what we have today into the future, kind of like when we projected energy and everyone was going to have these huge, you know, energy consuming things, but instead they're like these little things that we all have in our homes. So I think it's these predictions that are actually quite inaccurate, because you're forgetting just how much AI is going to change in the next 10 years.
Just in terms of how we counter, I mean, one of the core things that we can do is like another traditional value that I want to bring back, and it's a sense of shame. We live in a world where there is just no shame. You know, you say one thing one day, you say another thing another day, and no one gives a damn, okay? Like Donald Trump acts like it doesn't, literally there is no concept of truth by which he must abide. You know, he launches wars, he changes his justification for why the war was launched approximately every 48, maybe 36 hours. He cannot articulate the aims he's trying to achieve. He stipulates moral ideas which he has no intention of holding by, for instance, his concern for the Iranian people who he spends the evening bombing. You know, that is a man with no sense of shame. Like, over the last week in British politics, I have seen pretty much all the press and most of right-wing politicians attack Keir Starmer for not joining the war in Iran, only to discover that it's unpopular, and then decide, oh, we're just going to start talking about what he needs to do to lower sort of prices at the pumps. And of course we shouldn't have gone into the war. At no point saying, oh, actually, we were wrong to say what we did. Kevin Bednock, the leader of the Conservative Party, Nigel Farage, the fag-stained leader of Reform Party. These guys didn't even apologise, didn't even acknowledge they changed their position. The same with the press. Now, on that basis, what do you do to try and control this stuff when it comes to journalists who deal with news that is inaccurate, when it comes to politicians who are not telling you the truth, when it comes to outlets that dredge up conspiracy theories? The Telegraph, which was once upon a time a respectable British newspaper, has just churning out lies about 15-minute cities, a completely harmless sort of idea, which basically says you should be able to get to work and to the shops in 15 minutes, and suggesting that it's a Stalinist plan to trap people in their homes as part of the climate change, just the most god-awful, godforsaken nonsense. They should be held for a sense of shame. You know, what have you done to your brand, to your journalistic values, to your conduct yourself personally as a human being, to spread this fictitious, turgid, toxic, democracy-smashing nonsense? That is one of the core mechanisms, and it's up to each person to say, no, I will hold them and I will make them feel that shame. They can feel a sense of reputational jeopardy by virtue of the kind of coverage and the kind of words that they state.
Matthew is a social psychologist. I can hear the clicks. Do we have the capacity to hold our politicians, in shame?
I think it's a perfectly valid thing that Ian's proposed here. I think what we've noticed has changed over the last sort of decade or so is really the ability for world leaders to promote wild ideas and really for there to be very few consequences for people. And part of that might be because they're just flooding the space with so many outlandish claims that there's just not the capacity for people to really, you know, grab onto any one thing and sort of prosecute them for that or make them feel a sense of shame, or there is no consequence for what they say. I think everybody here and maybe everybody listening and people who aren't, you know, on the border of psychopathy or narcissism or those kind of extreme ends probably do experience shame. But we're also expecting that of elected leaders and particular people who are in powerful positions in corporations and so forth, people who probably self-select into those roles because of those particular qualities that they have, which are the ones that, in this sense, are least desirable for us. So we might be able to experience a sense of shame, I suspect, and we might expect that others do, but I'm not sure if that's necessarily going to be the solution that brings it back to what we might hope for. We still need guardrails on this. We still need, you know, actual government intervention. We need, you know, things outside individual, you know, we need collective efforts, but they also need to be done, I think, at a level and a scale beyond just the individual. So I think just calling for individuals to do something, I think, is a great first step. But we also need, industries, we need governments really to be behind these notions.
And I think in my work at National AI Centre and now at Alchemy Impact, thinking about responsible AI is actually a really big deal, right? Because it's thinking about, and businesses are now, you know, we're not going to have huge AI laws in Australia, but we still have all our regulators that, you know, make sure that what you're saying is true, that, you know, regulate the financial industries. We've got the Office of Confidentiality Information that regulates some of the health AI companies. We've got APRA, who does banking. We've got a range of different regulators. So I think, you know, we are, industry is being held account. I don't know who regulates the politicians. That's us voting for
them. It's the electorate. Yeah.
Thinking about our consumption, though, because as we get to the end of this talk, I think it's maybe good that we think of a solution if we have to have one. Our news consumption is full of all sorts of things, but a way for us to kind of avoid this, to skirt, you know, the AI-generated disinformation, may be to look at trusted brands. But for someone like you, Ian, you know, you write for a political newsletter, the iPaper, that would mean the end of your career. If we just centralised our trust in certain brands and certain types of misinformation, certain types of information.
Are you sure? I mean, maybe I'd survive. Maybe they'd think I was quite
trustworthy. I'm writing the tombstone now.
I really hear the regulation thing, and you're right, everything has to end up in regulation. But I do think loads of this is to do with individual choices that you make as a consumer, right? Like, each click, I spent 15 years on the back end of a website, and we saw what you clicked on. Like, we're very aware of what you guys are clicking on, okay? People will produce more of what you click on and what you tap on with your phone, with your, I beg your pardon, with your thumb on your phone. Like, my friend used to work in a newsroom. I really respect, I'm not even going to say where it is, but it's a despicable that it came to this. But he used to work in a newsroom for a major British newspaper. And they put a screen, a big screen, above all the journalists, just showing which stories were the most popular at that particular moment. In other words, saying to them, your version of success as a journalist is to do the most popular story. Now, what happens, right? Like, you can spend 6 months working on an undercover investigation about the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, okay? And I can assure you that very few people are going to read that story, okay? Or you can do something about where we are with European, you know, negotiations over agricultural regulations. Really important. Could impact the next, you know, pandemic. Very few people are going to read it. You do one story about a man with three nipples, and I can assure you, it'll be the most popular story that day. And in fact, in that particular example, it was the most popular story for weeks on end. So you sit there, and this is a real example. So you sit there working on your journalism, doing the work. And instead, every day, what you get from the place that you work is a big screen saying you failed unless you were the guy that wrote the story about the bloke with three nipples. So that stuff comes up. That does come down to the... Obviously, newsrooms should not be incentivizing in that way, and they can absolutely, you know, get screwed for what they did. But it does a lot as well come down to consumers. You do have to think that click, that is not a consequence-free click. Each time you click, you make a statement about the kind of journalism that you want to see more of in the world. And I hope that people think quite deeply about that the next time they do press that little button.
It's a great story idea for tomorrow. Thank you. Just going to jot that down. Three nipples. It'll be
this
on
is
Radio
just
National
your editorial
Breakfast.
Meeting tomorrow. Yeah.
It's a good brainstorm.
Find me someone with three nipples, guys. I hear this works.
Breaking news. So we are nearing the end, but we would love to get some of your questions. If I think questions have been written down and some have been collected. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And I'm going to attempt to read all of your handwriting, which I'm sure is incredible. Thank you very much. There's a question here from a teacher and a parent of young children. They say they support the social media ban, but they worry that the side effect of this will be that we'll see it as a solution to so many problems and become complacent in the need to teach media literacy properly. Do you think that policy will replace our need for media literacy and, I guess, individual responsibility here?
Again, this is outside of my central area of expertise, but I read widely on this because of an interest in terms of how this panned out and how scientific research leads to government policy. In that sense, I hope it wouldn't replace anything, and I hope it's a first step and a conversation and perhaps brings attention and focus to the potential harms that this is causing some people, but certainly as a panacea, it's certainly, I hope, not being promoted as such. Of course, the evidence for and the causal evidence for the effect of social media on mental health, well-being, other negative adverse outcomes on kids is mixed, and it's still not there, so it's still developing. One of the potentially beneficial things about actually doing this is that there are lots of very clever people around the world working with Australian scientists and researchers trying to understand what the effect of this is on Australian kids at the moment. So it's a unique opportunity to understand a little bit more, but it's not necessarily, I would say, looking at all, like a lot of the wide research, there actually isn't a lot of evidence supporting the call for a social media ban and for it to have an immediate impact on young kids.
I've got a question that I think relates to your past research, because you looked at conspiracy theories and also how to talk to people who believe in conspiracy theories. There's one question here saying, on trust, when my husband states, you believe what you see on your phone, he consumes Sky News and TikTok. I read articles from The Age and The Guardian. How do I respond?
I think it's lovely for people to have differing views and differing viewpoints. And,
very diplomatic.
No, but that's generally the approach. You know, I think we often don't talk to people who hold different beliefs than ourselves or have different ideologies or find things, you know, different religions or whatever it is, right? So we're not usually put in a position where we're having challenging conversations. I think when you talk to people who have differing beliefs, whether they're about conspiracy theories or something else, like your favourite football team, right? Like why you think they're the best and you know, maybe that's very flippant. But you really have to start from a position of understanding why the person, you know, has that belief. And I think, you know, through asking questions, through really trying to get, you know, developing a sense of empathy and rapport with them and putting yourself in their shoes, you might come to understand that, you know, the reason they find Sky News or whatever appealing is because it kind of fits in with what they already believe. You know, maybe they're addicted or hooked to kind of news that makes them, I don't know, feel awful about things in the world and fearful about other things. I don't know. I've only ever been on Sky News once and I don't readily watch it. But again, I'll consume certain types of media. So I think it's starting from that position where you have to listen to another person and really understand what it is that's maybe suspending that belief or driving that belief. And it's only then that you can maybe, if your goal is to maybe convince somebody otherwise that what they believe is, you know, not really suspended in reality, that then you can start to maybe, you know, address those fears. And so what we know in conspiracy theories is it's usually things around epistemic uncertainty, so needing to know, existential threat, feeling like insecure, or these aspects of social belonging that really drive people's conspiracy theory beliefs. It's not just, I know the facts. So telling people the facts and what you think are the facts often doesn't change people's views. I don't know how many people in this room have tried those approaches. I think they're the approaches we start with first. And I think they're the ones that make most sense to us because we like to think of ourselves as rational actors who know things, who have developed our knowledge through research and all these things, and ignore the fact that we heard maybe some experts on this podcast or something at some point say something, and maybe now that's our viewpoint, right? But once we kind of come to this position that, you know, often what we come to know and come to believe is shaped often through a social process, it becomes much easier to kind of navigate that space and appreciate that others can have different beliefs than our own.
And Ian, just for your benefit, Sky News in here compared to the UK, very different.
Yeah, I've been told that this trip. And it's crazy. Like, Sky News is really quite genuinely quite respectable in the UK. It's like,
yeah. Not here.
But on this idea, because your very job is column writing and it is, you know, conveying an idea and it is speaking to people who, you know, may have different viewpoints to yourself, how do you navigate that? How?
Oh, no, I'm not the person for that. Because everything you're saying is true. Like, all of the stuff is how you talk to people is you don't judge them, you don't just shout that they're wrong, you know, but I love doing all of those things. So you never use me for that kind of thing. Like, it's just not, so there's no social utility to that.
But I think conversation is really important. I was actually mentioning that I was involved in Australia's first internet cafe, and that's where we would come together and talk about this new technology. And I think conversation, when you're looking at social media or you're looking at TikTok and having a discussion about what you're looking at, is super important, because you do need to get that critical thinking, and you get that by hanging out with people and appreciating different opinions.
That's where we're going to have to leave it today. I'm so sorry. But thank you so much for engaging and for listening and for being here for this conversation. I want to thank all of our panellists. Firstly, you know, and I guess the takeaway from today, because there are so many, which you'll be able to listen back on the ABC's Big Ideas program and try and work out what the exact takeaway is. But maybe it's to be more of an active consumer, you know, to actually think about and be deliberate with how you're consuming media, whether that's, you know, the radio or social media or your uncle's WhatsApp chats, or whether that is the news summary that you're getting from Gemini and Google, probably trying to make a choice in how you're consuming the news media might actually just benefit your consumption of it. So thank you very much for your time.
The old saying, you get the media you deserve. Maybe it's never been more prescient than right now. On ABC Radio National and ABC Listen, this is Big Ideas. Our guests today, UK political columnist and author of Conspiracy Theory, The Story of an Idea, Ian Dunt, La Trobe University psychologist Dr. Matthew Marks, AI consultant Rita Arrigo, and the host was my colleague Luke Sidham-Dundon, who you can catch each weekday with all the latest news, factual, accurate, agenda-free, on ABC Radio National Breakfast, and he also hosts the Breakfast Wrap podcast. with thanks today to the Brimbank Writers and Readers Festival, the Sunshine Library, and to ABC sound engineer Brendan O'Neill for that conversation. My name is Natasha Mitchell. You can email me and the show at bigideas@abc.net.au. We love hearing from you. Big Ideas is all about giving you a front row seat to the best live events. So suggest any that you know are coming up. And if you love us, leave us a review on podcast apps and share us with your friends. I'll catch you next time. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.